Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest revelations of duplicity and double dealing by Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who has been conducting secret negotiations with the Taliban without informing his American and NATO allies. Marvin Weinbaum, the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State, joins us to discuss what Karzai is trying to achieve with these secret talks while he continues to refuse to sign the deal he brokered for security after Western troops leave. Then we'll look into the giant trillion-dollar farm bill the president is expected to sign that cuts food stamps and alters direct payments in farm subsidies, which up until now have paid farmers whether they plant crops or not. Dr. Darrell Ray, the Chair of Excellence in Agricultural Policy, Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics and Director of the Agriculture Policy Analysis Center at the University of Tennessee, joins us to discuss the winners and losers in this bill and why we have farm subsidies in the first place. Then finally, we'll speak with Laura Schmidt, a professor of health policy at the School of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, who wrote the commentary for a new study by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, published in Monday's Journal of the American Medical Association, that finds Americans are consuming too much sugar and that sugar is killing us. We'll discuss the findings that show that not only does sugar make us fat, it also makes us sick and contributes to cardiovascular disease, the major cause of death in America. And joining us now is Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003. He was a senior fellow at the United States Institute for Peace and held Fulbright Research Fellowships for Afghanistan and Egypt. Marvin Weinbaum is an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois, where he directed the program in South Asia and Middle East Studies, and he's authored numerous books, including The Future of Afghanistan, and he has an article at Foreign Policy, Reading Hamid Karzai. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marvin Weinbaum.
Thank you.
So it looks as though Karzai, of course, we know that Hamid Karzai has refused to sign the deal brokered for security after Western troops leave, and this is something he had agreed with, and his own lawyer, Jirga, his own parliament of elders, have also signed off on it. My understanding up until now has been that what Karzai is doing is that he doesn't want to sign the agreement until after the elections because he wants to be free to rig the elections as he did the ones that re-elected him in order to get his hand-picked successor so he can keep in the game. That's been my understanding, but I take it you think there's other motives.
Yes, I do. I really don't think that whether he signs it or not will be a factor in whether he chooses to influence the course of the election, because he does have some ability to control the management of the election while he's president. Most observers have thought, well, this is just his hard bargaining, and he wants to get the best possible deal and to string it out so that he can be relevant up until the early April election. That's been the conventional wisdom on this.
So what is this new report then about him making secret contacts with the Taliban? How does that affect the picture?
Well, there are many people who think that what is really involved here is that he has real doubts about the future of his own country, and that he is rather desperate to see whatever we do in staying or not, that there is a political solution to go along with this economic transition and security transition that's taking place. And that he has said as one of his conditions here that the United States effectively should bring the Taliban to the table. We have indicated that we've done about all we could do on that score, and we've now reached the point where we don't expect any kind of arrangement. But he's, according to this most recent report, he secretly made contacts without telling us, and that's just added to the irritation that's felt here in Washington toward him, that he hasn't been straight with us, and that we very well don't know what he's planning, and if he is talking to the Taliban, what he's prepared to concede, because that's very important if we're going to have anything to show for these 12 years in Afghanistan.
So what do we know about who he's talking to then, Karzai?
What we've heard is that he's speaking to those people who are called the Quetta Shura. And this is the group around Mullah Omar, who is the titular leader of the whole insurgent movement. Up until now, there have been contacts made, and they've all really led nowhere. And there was a effort to actually begin negotiations in Qatar earlier, last year, and that fell apart. So this group has, as far as most of us have viewed it, has really no serious desire to enter negotiations because the simple reason, they think they're winning. Why would they want to compromise in any way? But in the meanwhile, what he has been doing here is to legitimize them and to confuse the situation in that Afghans are naturally asking, as everybody else is, are they the enemy or are they negotiating partners?
So there's also negotiations, at least they're sort of starting, or they're somewhat stalled, between the government of Pakistan and Pakistan's Taliban as well, are they not?
Yes, that's much further along, and the Pakistan government has named four emissaries to the negotiations, and the Taliban are also, and this is the Pakistani Taliban, and they have to be distinguished from the Afghan Taliban, although they share an ideological agenda, but their objectives certainly now are different. That is more serious, but once again, when one hears the terms on which they seem to be willing to reach an agreement with the government, they are really so far out of line with anything that the government could accept. Effectively, the government would have to agree to change the political system. And they may just be starting points in the negotiation, but they've laid out a series of these, and it doesn't seem like any one of which could upset any serious negotiation.
And again, I'm speaking with Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003. And he is the author of a number of books, including The Future of Afghanistan, and has an article at Foreign Policy, Reading Hamid Karzai. And that in itself, reading Hamid Karzai, has been something of a torturous exercise for a lot of people. I've spoken... With the former U.S. Ambassador Galbraith, who was the number two UN official there, who basically got kicked out of the country by Karzai for blowing the whistle on how much Karzai rigged the elections. And we've had any number of American officials privately complain about his mercurial behavior. Some have suggested that he may be bipolar. Others have suggested that he might imbibe a lot in the local drugs like hashish. What's your sense of why he seems to be so mercurial?
Well, one of the problems here is that, and one can chalk this up to paranoia if you wish, but I think it's very clear here that the man seriously believes all of the conspiracy theories that one hears these days in Afghanistan. And most of these conspiracy theories involve the United States as having malevolent motives towards Afghanistan. He's surrounded himself with a group of people who, by all indications that we have been feeding this desire on his part to accept these kinds of explanations, such as, for example, that the United States is really plotting with Pakistan to divide up his country, or the United States wishes to unseat, he believes that the United States has been trying to unseat him, that the United States is planning to use his country as a strategic base against other countries in the region, and so on. But they get really quite outlandish. And from, again, every indication we have, is he seriously believes these. And that's been a problem, because it's hard to have, it's hard to connect with him when he hold, when he harbors these kinds of views.
Well, I've spoken a number of times to Christine Fair, the specialist on Afghanistan and Pakistan at Georgetown University, who speaks most of the local languages. And she and others have described the Karzai regime as a narco-kleptocracy, and that so much of the money has been parked in the Gulf. And, I mean, is this another unfortunate case of the U.S. just backing a loser, like we did in Vietnam, like we did with Chiang Kai-shek? I mean, is it?
You know, we've got to look beyond this. There's no question about the fact that this regime is just riddled with corruption. But, you know, would one expect otherwise when this there's this large amount of money which has been sent there over the years? But I say one has to look beyond this. There is a country here, and there's a country with people. And there are a great many people who are very honestly trying to make this country work, that have they're stakeholders in this country. And if we write off the country simply because, indeed, it has had poor leadership, this is serious. Of course it is, and it's something that we have to be concerned about. But we also have to understand that we went in there and we put in this government, and that we've created responsibilities as well. And the idea that we would simply wipe our hands of it because of people like this is really being unfair to the people, and ultimately, I believe, creating a circumstances where we may find a re-establishment of groups like al-Qaeda. So I think there's a great deal at stake here for us, and we shouldn't use simply the fact of this corruption and this poor leadership. We may, for example, if we can get through a clean election, or at least a relatively clean election, it won't be clean, a relatively clean election, if we could get through this, we might be able to come up with a new president who would be of a very different caliber. For example, the two leading candidates at the moment are both pro-American, and people who I know both of them personally, let me say, and I have the highest regard for them. They would give us, I believe, a kind of leadership that we've not seen.
But the question that's always asked is whether or not the Afghans will be able to maintain and manage their own security after the U.S. and NATO leave. And that gets to the heart of whether or not talking with the Taliban now would forestall military action, or whether military action is inevitable. And a lot of analysts say that the Taliban could really be very much more effective than the military that we've stood up.
And well, I don't entirely buy that. We've obviously, this military is not up to snuff. It needs a lot more work, and that's one reason why keeping a 10,000 or so there, would include trainers, will be very important. I can say this, Ian, that if we walk away from it, if we're asked to leave, or we decide to leave, there's no question that this military will come apart. But if we're there, I think that there is a possibility, and not a small possibility, that it can withstand the Taliban, because we have to start with this premise that most Afghans don't want to see the Taliban come back. The Taliban are, to the extent that they have any appeal, it has been because the government has let them down. But the public, by and large, would like to see their government work. They want to see responsible leadership. Again, if we wipe our hands of it, then we have certainty that this was going to lead to civil war. And if that happens, we may very well have a regional instability, not just instability in Pakistan, because if Afghanistan effectively fails, then I believe that the heat is really going to be on Afghanistan. The implications here for a stable Pakistan, which is already a tenuous state in many respects, a failure in Afghanistan is going to blow back on Pakistan. And the radical groups there, including the Taliban, and there are other groups as well, are effectively going to be energized by just that kind of development.
So is there then a sense that people who don't want the Taliban to come back, and there have been some improvements, nothing to match the amount of investments made, both in lives and treasure, by the U.S. and NATO, but still, what can they do? I mean, at the end of the day, just because you want a better government, the guys with guns don't care, right?
Yes, I think that it's true. This is going to be a tough slog here to make this work. But the ingredients are there, really, I believe, to give them a fair chance of being able to withstand the Taliban. And at the moment, we have to recognize that the Taliban don't control any territory. They're influential in certain parts of the country. But at the moment, the government still has the upper hand, and it can protect the largest parts of the population. Its ability to continue to do so is going to hinge on this election resulting in a legitimate government past April. And by the way, even though the election is in April, we probably won't see a sitting government until June or July, because it'll go through a runoff and then until a new cabinet is chosen. I think the concern of some people like myself is that by that point, the United States is going to become so exasperated with Karzai that we will have pulled the plug. But if we're willing to wait it out until we can see whether there does emerge this kind of leadership, then I think it's worth it. Look, we've invested so much here. If a small investment now in keeping 10,000 or so troops there for at least 2 or 4 years more, if not longer, but at least that, if we can stabilize this country, then the Taliban and the people who have been supporting them will recognize that time is not on their side, and that's the best opportunity. We won't get a grand deal with the Taliban. I don't believe that's ever going to take place. We won't get that. But what we can get is a demoralization of the Taliban, particularly if certain elements of the insurgency begin to defect, and if people say, wait a second now, we've got some faith in this government going forward. The kind of faith they had in the international community and in their own government for the first 4 or 5 years after we went in. So it was there earlier. We forfeited it. The question is, can we get it back?
Well, just in closing, Marvin Weinbaum, you mentioned the pivotal role of Pakistan and how an unstable Afghanistan will further destabilize an already shaky Pakistan. That, you would think, would resonate with Pakistan's leaders, and it doesn't appear to. I mean, do they really – they've been, you know, sponsoring the Taliban, harboring them clandestinely, arming them, whatever. I mean, they've been stab eggs in the back, to put it bluntly, for the longest time. Do they get it? Do they understand what you just said?
Well, I think that they have come to an understanding that a Taliban victory is not in their interest. That is, with the Taliban, because this is different than the 1990s when they didn't have an insurgency of their own on their hands. Now they recognize that a Taliban victory would be dangerous to them. They don't want a civil war. So for them at this point, what would suit their purposes is to have a coalition government, a power sharing in Kabul. And they have actually made some efforts in this regard. The fact is, though, that they don't want to see that kind of arrangement emerge unless it's one in which they are able to at least partly write the script. They want to be sure that their interests are taken care of. So they will drop the Taliban, at least this Mullah Omar group, if they feel they don't need them. They still think they need them as an asset because they have no confidence at this point that things won't come apart, and if they do, then they want to have a friendly force there. But let's not fool ourselves. They don't trust the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, and the Afghan Taliban, for that matter, don't trust Pakistan.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Marvin Weinbaum.
Surely.
Again, I've been speaking with Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003. And he's authored numerous books, including The Future of Afghanistan. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Reading Hamid Karzai. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and look into the giant trillion-dollar farm bill. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Darrell Ray, who is the Blessingame Chair of Excellence in Agricultural Policy, Professor of Agriculture and Resource Economics, and Director of the Agricultural Policy Analysis Center at the University of Tennessee. Dr. Ray was raised on a general crop and livestock farm in central Iowa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Darrell Ray.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And the Congress is going to pass out this massive trillion-dollar farm bill, which comes to about $100 billion a year for the next 5 years. And what's been getting the headlines, of course, has been the cuts in food stamps, which could have been worse, I guess. Let's bring it at that point. They ended up with the Senate compromise, which is much less draconian than the House.
That's correct. I think that they ended up with about an $8 billion reduction from what they were working from over the 10-year period, but that's a lot different than that the House was after. They were originally after about $40 billion in reduced funding for the SNAP program, which is really the food stamp program.
And that's a big part of the bill, is it not?
It's a major part of the bill. Most of it is for nutrition and for SNAP, the food stamp program. So, yes, it's a large component of the farm bill.
And it affects one in seven Americans. But obviously there are those. In fact, in your own state, there's a congressman who went to the floor and made a speech quoting the Bible, saying he who does not work does not deserve to eat. I'm paraphrasing. And apparently his family farm receives substantial subsidies. So there seems to be an element of hypocrisy here, is there not?
I think what's been happening to some extent is that with the, you know, the Great Recession, as we like to call it here, there's been a tremendous increase in the amount of number of folks that have applied for the SNAP program, and then the benefits have been increased a little bit, and so it appears that there's a mammoth proportion or increase in proportion of the population and increase in the use of food stamps, which is probably more transitory than permanent. But I think that we have some folks that are viewing it as permanent, and they are always, it's always possible to find anecdotal stories about people that are taking advantage of it or in some ways either getting too much or don't deserve it in one fashion or another, at least in their mind. And so the stories can come out, and some of them have some relevance. And of course, there's always going to be a little bit of administrative slack there, and you have to expect a little bit of problems with getting it administered without any errors. But in general, it's been a very successful program, and is of course very important to millions and millions of folks in this country to provide food and nutrition that they otherwise wouldn't be able to afford.
But when, for example, Senator Gillibrand from New York says this bill will result in less food on the table for children, seniors, and veterans who deserve better from this Congress, while corporations continue to receive guaranteed federal handouts. Mm-hmm. I cannot vote for it. Now, that sounds, on the surface, pretty unjust.
Well, there's a lot of disagreement about what is appropriate for spending on agriculture per se, on production agriculture, and exactly how it should be administered and what the components of that farm bill should be. We've moved to kind of an insurance, revenue insurance type of program, and using direct payments or some kind of payment. And so, you know, many of those attributes and programs do tend to favor those that grow the most. And since they favor the folks that grow the most, why then sometimes the amount that they're paid to offset some of the disasters and uncertainties that they face as farmers look exceedingly out of proportion. So I think it's possible to defend and to, you know, castigate, depending on your view and on the specific circumstance that you're looking at.
So given your background, Dr. Ray, how do you see American agriculture? I mean, my understanding is that over the decades, the family farm has become an endangered species and agribusiness has taken over. What are the figures on that?
There's really a dichotomy involved here. In terms of the livestock operations, it is true that many of those are very large and are integrated and corporate or, you know, that type of discussion or, you know, a characterization is actually fairly appropriate. However, for crop agriculture, one could argue that there are still family farms out there. It's just that they're larger and maybe they're extended families. But if you went out and talked to them, whether you're talking in central Kansas to a wheat farmer or to a corn and soybean farmer in Illinois, and you said, are you a family farmer or not? To a person, they would suggest that they are. So there's a little bit of misunderstanding, I think, about the nature of how agriculture is organized, especially on the crop side. And that's the one in which that is the side of agriculture that federal farm programs are aimed at. And on the livestock side, why you have more concentration, they're able to affect the supply and in a way that they can meet demand at a price that is profitable. But on the crop side, you have millions of individual entrepreneurs, none of which can affect the price. And so it's that side of agriculture that tends to be the focus for federal farm programs.
Well, apparently the final compromise bill gets rid of the controversial direct payment subsidies,
yes,
which are paid to farmers whether or not they farm or not. And that program was $4.5 billion annual cost has been redirected into a new program that I guess is a little more palatable in as much as the subsidies only kick in when the farmer has actual losses. Is that the big change here?
Yes, that is. The direct payments, as they were called, were paid, as you said, whether the prices were high, and of course there these last couple of years prices have been high, or whether they're low, and they don't increase when prices are low. And so they really didn't provide a safety net in the true sense that we would normally think of it. And so some of the changes that we've seen in this farm bill do tend to be more counter-cyclical and therefore provide a safety net that is more relevant.
But in terms of American agriculture, if you drive across the middle of the country, all you ever see is just corn forever. And a lot of critics of agriculture policy have said it's been completely distorted with corn for both gasohol, alcohol, and mixed with gasoline, and it goes into feedstock. And, I'm trying to get a sense of whether this bill is dealing with the rise of a kind of culture in food, an alternative culture in food that's taking place, the slow food movement, it's often called. You know that across the country, farmers' markets are proliferating. People are more concerned about nutrition. How does this new bill affect specialty crops like fruits and vegetables and organic produce?
I think there are a couple of ways. One is that there are some monies that put into the bill for fruits and vegetables for research and marketing that wasn't there before. Another way that it's been included is that the value of the food stamps that you use in farmers markets are to be doubled, so that if you buy food from a farmer at a farmers market rather than at your grocery store, it'll go twice as far. Those are a couple of things that I think, you know, might make some difference and are in the farm bill.
So the same bill that cut 1% of food stamps, cut 1% of the recipients of food stamps, has added this bonus then, that if you go to a farmer's market, you get double your money?
Yeah, yes. Uh-huh. And there were some problems with administering the food stamp program, too, where we would have some administrative ways of streamlining who is eligible that made a lot of sense, at least it seemed to, where if you were eligible for a subsidy, housing subsidy, reduced payment or rent for a housing subsidy, well, then you'd be automatically eligible for food stamps, for example, and you wouldn't have to go through the process and all of the administrative hassle of doing it. Well, there are a number of those kinds of things, and one of them that came up was if you're eligible for a heat subsidy, you might say, or a fuel subsidy to fuel your furnace or whatever in the wintertime, if you received that benefit, well, then you also would be eligible for food stamps. And you know, there were some in some places why, you know, if they got a $5 or $10 for 1 month, well, then that put them made them available for food stamps. Well, so, you know, some of the things that we've done in the past, and some of the most conservative folks have been for in terms of streamlining and reducing the administrative costs, had to be modified somewhat in order to bring them back and be sure that the program wasn't taken advantage of. So some of that 1% does probably make some sense if you look at some of the legitimate reasons why some folks should not be included. But again, I would argue that most of the increase in participation has been because of the general condition of the economy over the last 5 years.
Well, Senator Grassley of Iowa, who has, of course, has been a senior member of the Agriculture Committee, which is now, of course, chaired by the Democrat Debbie Stabenow of Michigan. Grassley apparently is going to vote against this bill because it doesn't include provisions that he'd authored to reduce the number of people on one farm who can collect subsidies. And apparently, for years, Grassley has fought to lower subsidies to the wealthiest farmers. So give us a sense of what Grassley's trying to point out, and clearly he lost this argument, because in general there is an impression that these farm subsidies are really are kind of corporate welfare.
Yes. Well, I think the thing that is bothering him the most is that while there is a limit of $125,000 per person, and so if you're married and the spouse is actively involved in network culture, that would be $250,000. But then I think the part that he disagrees with completely is that if there are other folks on the farm that serve as managers, they also could have the $125,000 as well. And so that provides a loophole so that a very large farmer could decide that he's going to say that this person, person A through E, also have managerial responsibilities on that farm, and therefore be eligible for the maximum of $125,000. I think it's that loophole that is bothering him the most. He probably would have preferred a lower limit to begin with, but the ability to expand the number of people on a farm through that loophole, I think, is the thing that bothers him the most.
Well, Dr. Darrell Ray, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? If you're an agribusiness company and you hire a bunch of managers to manage your property that you're getting these subsidies for, under that loophole, that would mean that you don't have to pay these people, in effect. You know, the government subsidizes their salaries.
I would just remind you, though, that that's not a typical situation in U.S. agriculture. The more typical situation might be that you have a father and a son or two that are farming together, perhaps in a corporation, but in a limited way or in a limited partnership. And so while you might have, you know, those three people involved, and if you do have, you are talking about a fairly, you know, probably covering a number of acres, which is maybe a little bit different than we might think of where Cargill owns half of a county and hires, you know, 300 managers and therefore could get 300 times 125,000. It's really not that kind of situation, But, you know, I wouldn't argue that there wouldn't be opportunities for some places and some people to take advantage of it nonetheless.
But just to ask you the emperor's clothes question, Dr. Darrell Ray, why do we need subsidies in the first place?
Well, I appreciate you asking that because that's really the core of what our discussion ought to be, and it tends not to be. And the problem is it takes a little time to explain it, but let me just give you the outline. You know, there are times in which we have demand increases or some kind of a reason for prices to be high and stay high for a number of years, and they happen ever so often. We had World War I, World War II, the 70s, and now with the ethanol thing. And that's been primarily because of some kind of a political thing, whether it's wars or whether it's Russia deciding that they're going to feed their livestock rather than slaughter it and not demand the feed when they have a pork grain crop, or it's an ethanol mandate or something. So we have those times, but then what happens is we have an expansion in the supply that comes along and in responding to those high prices, and then we have overproduction, and then prices fall, and it takes a while for that to happen. And so that's what's happening right now. But in general, what happens is that we tend to see supply increase faster because of technological advance in yields, primarily or often because the public has spent money on research and actually causing those yield increases to be in existence. Then export demand and domestic demand will keep up, and so prices decline, and then we don't see the adjustment for food like we see for other things. I mean, I say that food is more like insulin to a diabetic than anything else. You'll pay whatever it takes to get the food you need, but if the price drops by 50%, you're not going to use any more. Well, it's not quite that inelastic, but it's pretty close. You'll change the mix, but you won't change the amount that comes off the market, so you don't balance a situation from the demand side. And on the supply side, you know, you don't. We have a lot of independent farmers, like we said, that can't affect the price by what they produce individually, and they are going to produce more of the crop. They are. If you go through that drive that you said through Central America, they are going to plant something on that ground. And so it takes a while for prices that have to be low for some time before the acreage and the yields are adjusted downward. So we don't get the adjustment on either the supply or the demand side that we do for most other products. You know, John Deere doesn't even make a combine until they have an order. Then we have other industries in which they can either have a particular shift or not have a shift. But anyway, they take into account what the demand will be at a price that they can be profitable with, and agriculture can't do it. So that's really why we have it, is have programs in terms of trying to provide some cushion when prices are low for a long period of time, and then also with variability when a disaster hits and you have a drought and it affects, you know, all of a particular state or something.
Like we have here in California, right?
Yes.
Well, Dr. Darrell Ray, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Again, I've been speaking with Darrell Ray, who's the Blasingame Chair of Excellence in Agriculture Policy, Professor of Agriculture and Resource Economics, and Director of the Agricultural Policy Analysis Center at the University of Tennessee. Dr. Ray was raised on a general crop and livestock farm in central Iowa. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how sugar is not only making us fat, it's killing us.
Sugar man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue corn, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams? Silver magic ships you carry, jumpers, coke, sweet Mary.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Laura Schmidt, who's a professor of health policy in the School of Medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. She also holds a joint appointment in the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies and the Department of Anthropology, History, and Social Medicine. And Laura, you're involved with this study published on Monday by the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine that finds that Americans consume too much sugar and our sweet tooth is killing us, to put it bluntly. We just got through talking about the new farm bill that's going through, $1 trillion over 10 years. And it's always struck me as a paradox that the Department of Agriculture is in charge of our nutrition. Is there a link there, just to finish up on what we've just been talking about, the farm policy cutting food stamps, the extent to which poor people in this country are reduced to buying sweet food laced with sugar in order to spread it across the table for the family who aren't getting the best nutrition, but they're getting what the parents or the usually a single mother can afford?
Well, yes, there's absolutely a connection between food production policies in the U.S. and the health of our population. And absolutely, there are significant issues with access to healthy food in vulnerable populations, populations of low-income folks in America, as well as ethnic minority populations. One of the more staggering findings from the study that the CDC scientists published in JAMA Internal Medicine on Monday, and I wrote an invited commentary on their piece, is that at the peak of our sugar consumption in the U.S., which was between 1999 and 2004, a remarkable 25.9% of African Americans were heavy consumers of added sugars compared to 15.6% of whites. So that's about a 10 percentage point difference in the rates at which African Americans, a vulnerable population, were heavily consuming added sugars compared to the white population. We see tremendous racial and ethnic and socioeconomic disparities, not only in access to healthy food, but also in the rates of chronic disease resulting from poor diet.
So it's not just that sugar makes us fat, it also makes us sick. Is that the bottom line here?
That is what the mounting evidence in the medical community is starting to add up to. And it used to be that the main thing when we studied sugar, we were mainly thinking about sugar as empty calories that are excess calories that make people overweight, maybe obese, and we were encouraging the American public to keep their sugar consumption down because we have an obesity epidemic on our hands. And there is little doubt that sugar overconsumption at the rates that we have in America is leading to higher rates of overweight and obesity. And we've also known for many years that there was a connection between eating too much sugar and heart disease. But we always thought it was because of the obesity factor. So what's shifted, this is kind of a major paradigm shift in the way scientists are approaching this kind of research, is we're starting to back up and say, wait a minute, maybe sugar isn't just a problem for getting fat, but it might actually have a direct relationship with chronic disease. And so what the scientists at the CDC did in their study, which was really path-breaking in that it's the first national population, general population study of the entire U.S. over a very extended period of time, over 30,000 people were part of this study. And what they show is that over time, increasing your high sugar consumption is directly associated with cardiovascular disease death. Happens to be the number one cause of death in America for both men and women is heart disease. That over time, heavy consumption, overconsumption of sugar is a risk factor in cardiovascular disease independent of weight, smoking, exercise, total calories in the diet. So thin people, people who exercise, still would have the added risk of heart disease associated with over-consuming sugar. And so this is a pretty big paradigm shift looking at the direct impact of sugar on health and chronic diseases that kill us prematurely. And this is a whole line of research. These scientists are coming out with a really path-breaking set of findings around the number one cause of death in America. But we've also had over the recent couple of years studies very much like this, linking heavy sugar consumption to diabetes and other chronic diseases. And all of these studies have been looking at this independent of whether a person is thin or overweight, independent of whether they're otherwise eating a healthy diet.
Now, I've spoken in the past with your colleague at UC San Francisco, Robert Lustig, who I've spoken to before, and he's written some very, very, very powerful books about sugar, which he is categorized as a toxin. He deals with chronic obesity in young children, which is a sort of cruel example, I think, of our national sweet tooth. It's looking more and more like Dr. Lustig is being vindicated.
Well, I think a lot of what Rob has been looking at is the one particular kind of sugar. There are a variety of different sugars, and our bodies actually metabolize some sugars differently from others. Mm-hmm. And one of the sugars that a lot of scientists are looking into, not just Rob, but Rick Johnson at University of Colorado, Kimber Stanhope at UC Davis. There are a lot of researchers, Miriam Voss at Emory University, who are looking at fructose. Fructose is the sugar that naturally occurs in sugars, in fruit.
Right, but it's high fructose corn syrup, isn't it?
Half of table sugar, so half of the sugar that, you know, if you were to say, if your package said organic beet sugar or organic cane sugar, it would still be 50% fructose. Mm-hmm. High fructose corn syrup varies in formulation. On average, the most common is 55% fructose, but it can go up to 90 and it can go as low as 45%. So fructose is pretty much, by rule of thumb, about half of the added sugar we're consuming contains fructose. And what's concerning about fructose is that it is largely metabolized in the liver. And one of the things that we're starting to see as we see rates of excess sugar consumption rising in the American population over the last 30 years is we're seeing increasing rates of a condition called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is something that we never actually even saw in the population prior to, say, the 1980s. So currently, fatty liver disease, typically you get that from alcohol consumption, heavy alcohol consumption. You'll get fatty liver disease, and ultimately, if it continues, it will lead to cirrhosis of the liver and require a liver transplant in order for the person to survive. What we're seeing today is that we're seeing increasing rates of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, not only in adults, but in children. So currently, it's estimated that 31% of U.S. adults have fatty liver disease, and 16% of children have fatty liver disease. Fatty liver disease, one of the hot areas of research is how fructose is metabolized in the liver. It is metabolized in ways that are quite similar to the way that alcohol is metabolized in the liver. And therefore, we're really looking much more carefully at the impact of fructose on liver function and whether it has any role to play in rising rates of fatty liver disease, non-alcoholic liver cirrhosis, and liver transplantation. This is now the fastest rising reason for liver transplantation in America. There are other dietary components that can lead to fatty liver disease. Trans fats have been researched as a risk factor, and obesity itself is a risk factor in the development of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. But this is an area of emerging research. There's further research looking at hormonal dysfunctions or dysregulation in the hormonal and metabolic systems consequential to heavy, heavy fructose consumption. One very cutting-edge area of research has to do with a hormone in the body called leptin, and it's essentially your own internal appetite suppressant. You don't have to go and buy an appetite suppressant off the drugstore shelf. You got your own internal hormone that when you've had a full a big meal, it tells your brain, hey, you're full, time to stop eating. Well, it turns out that through a very complicated cascade of changes in metabolic and hormonal functioning within the body, we're seeing that people who are morbidly obese and over-consumers of fructose have a condition called leptin resistance, where their brain somehow, there's the signaling in their hormonal systems that says time to stop eating stops working. And this, in fact, may be one explanation for why we're seeing rising rates of sugar consumption track so closely to rising rates of obesity in the American population.
Well, Laura Schmidt, I brought up the high fructose corn syrup because it's ubiquitous. If you go to the supermarket and you look at the labels on the contents, and you'll find high fructose corn syrup in just about everything that's on the shelves.
There's added sugar in 77% of packaged foods in your grocery store.
77%.
77% of packaged foods have sugar added to them. Foods that don't even taste sweet have sugar added to them. Bagels, bread, ketchup, barbecue sauce, salad dressing. We have added sugar in the vast majority of foods in our grocery stores. And so the real question I think that emerges is, how can, if we've got sugar added to 77% of what we eat, how can an individual navigate the food environment and come up with a healthy diet for themselves and their children? And this is where I think the debate really does turn back to where you started, to governmental solutions to the problem, that we really need to start looking at regulatory strategies for addressing the abundance, the saturation of food in the food supply. We need to make it much easier for individual consumers to navigate food labels. We need a national government-approved dietary limit on how much sugar is safe to consume, added sugar is safe to consume. And we need to be looking at evidence-based policies that we know are effective at lowering consumption of products that are harmful to health. And probably the biggest evidence base we have is for the taxation of harmful products to health. We know from alcohol, tobacco, and a growing body of research on sugary beverage taxation that this strategy is very effective at encouraging consumers without constraining their choices, incentivizing consumers to consume less of the unhealthy sugary beverages. And it's sort of a virtuous cycle, because if you take the money raised by those fees on distributors or taxes on consumers and you devote those to programs targeting the most vulnerable populations of children who are suffering from chronic diseases related to sugar overconsumption, most notably rising rates of type 2 diabetes, rates that we were not seeing type 2 diabetes in children 30 years ago. We're seeing it in growing rates in America. If we can take those tax dollars or those fees on distributors and use them to support programs that help get healthy water and healthy beverages into our schools and getting healthy foods, fresh produce into our low-income communities, we can really turn the tide on this growing problem.
Well, Laura Schmidt, along with the study that you wrote the commentary on in the Journal of American Medicine's Internal Medicine, that's a study done by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on how sugar is, Americans are consuming too much sugar and our sweet tooth is killing us. Along with that, of course, the World Health Organization has just come out with a study saying that we are facing a tidal wave of cancer. The globe is facing a tidal wave of cancer. And the World Health Organization's World Cancer Research Fund is saying in this study that there's an alarming level of naivety about diet's role in cancer, specifically singling out sugar and alcohol contributing to obesity and cancer and other diseases. So it seems like not just on the national level there's a wake-up call, but also on the international level there's a similar wake-up call coming from
absolutely. And the United Nations has held two, now almost three, high-level meetings on the issue of non-communicable disease epidemics worldwide, namely chronic diseases like the ones we've been talking about, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease. And it's an important debate that we need to be having because we are now seeing that people worldwide, and even in developing societies, in low and middle income societies, are dying at higher rates from chronic disease, the disease, so-called diseases of affluence, than they are from infectious diseases, infant diarrhea disease, malaria, tuberculosis, and so forth. And so this points to what are the modifiable risk factors that help us prevent people from dying from chronic disease. And they're really a very short list: alcohol, tobacco, unhealthy diet, and physical inactivity. And those need to be the targets of worldwide public health interventions. And what we're seeing overseas is a growing trend towards addressing these risk factors at the level of various nation states around the world. Remarkably, we now have 15 countries globally that regulate sugary beverages through taxation, the newest one being Mexico, that just last month began implementing a sugary beverage taxation system nationally. So this is a growing trend worldwide as we start to look at our food systems, at the distribution networks, how packaged processed food, diets heavily reliant on packaged and processed foods, are impacting the health of populations. And cancer is one of a host of chronic diseases that are linked to these so-called lifestyle risk factors. And the more that we can do at the global level, at the level of governments, of nation states, and even at the local and state levels, to create environments that produce health rather than environments that produce disease, the better. And that's where this debate, these debates around sugary beverage taxation, and really that's where they, that's the focus of these debates. How can we create environments that are more conducive to health?
Well, Laura Schmidt, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Laura Schmidt, who's a professor of health policy in the School of Medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. She holds a joint appointment in the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies and the Department of Anthropology, History, and Social Medicine. And she wrote the commentary for a study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published in Monday's Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Stan Mizrahi. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.